All right, Tim, let's start actually before Jim Rose and talk about how you first sort of discovered this this Torture King identity.
The acts that I do, actually, I read about when I was very young. In elementary school, there was a book in the library which had descriptions of people doing kind of strange performances around the world and throughout history. And in there, they had people in India doing the skewers through the cheeks. They had people in sideshows doing sword swallowing, people walking in red hot coals, and I found that very fascinating and wanted to see people doing that. And I found out nobody was really doing it anymore. There was actually a circus that came through my town, which is a small town in Washington State. It was a university town, and my dad was a professor at the university. But a circus came through, and it did have a sideshow. But it was all magic tricks when I went in there. They had the blade box, I remember, a few other things, and none of the things I'd read about. But it was something that fascinated me, and I kept collecting information wherever I could, however I could. And it was never like a big, strong, at first, another big, strong fascination, but something I just kept my eye on and paid attention to, and see things, and things like Ripley's Believe It or Not, and TV shows like That's Incredible were on at the time, would have people doing these type of things. So,
now you said the word you used was performance, rather than say a personal exploration.
Yes, in fact, I got into this, and that's always been how I presented it. It's from the entertainment angle, even though some of the things that were shown in the book were being exhibited to people not so much as performance, they were brought and presented as that way. For instance, the people in India putting the skewers through the cheeks and laying in beds of nails was something that travelers would see and then bring the people back, you know, physically bring these people back from India, have them do the things they just do on the streets and do that on the stage, and now it's entertainment. So, but it was seen as a completely different thing in India.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first move from just researching it to actually giving it a try? Or were there other sort of explorations in S&M that sort of led into it?
No, actually, everything I did was from the performance aspect, and that's how I saw it. Some other people would look at it and view it as something else, but I'd do it and. This could get me in trouble at times. You see, I would remember doing in home economics class in school, I would take the sewing pins and put them through the skin of my forearm to amuse my fellow students, and the teacher wasn't very amused by this and saw it as something self-destructive. But I had actually no idea why they would think that. The entire view I had on it was as the performance, mm-hmm. as the entertainment angle of it, too. And I also have been studying self-hypnosis since I was very young. I knew that was involved in it, and I'd gotten books on hypnosis and self-hypnosis, so a lot of it is changing the state of the mind I was in. So I never saw it at all as anything like that, anything S&M or anything like that, and actually only found out about that much, much later.
Now, if you're mentioning self-hypnosis, is that that was to eliminate the pain aspect?
Yes, it's to change the perception of pain. And I had also, you know, studied states of kind of raising the temperature and the slowing heartbeat, changing the functions of the body, changing, to some degree, your automatic functions.
How have you actually tried that? How real is that?
It's very, very real. The pain is something quite easy to control as opposed to some other aspects. A lot of what you have as pain is a conditioned reflex. Pain is a combination. Actually, everything in life is a combination of an external stimuli and then your brain reacting to that, and that'll have an output. And you really can't control what's happening outside you. And how you react internally can be changed, and that'll change the output, and that in turn will create kind of a loop and will change the actual change the way you are, change reality in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And pain especially is one that from a very early age, you know, you touch the stove and it burns you. Now next time you see the stove, you have this negative, you know, hot stove, you know, oh, even before you touch it, oh, draw the hand away. a lot of it's really learned, and it's the anticipation of pain that can make it worse. In fact, you can change that, use the same techniques, and the anticipation of pleasure can make that better as well.
Mm-hmm.
I can definitely show you, when I'm doing my show, I'm putting some big skewer through my arm, and I'm handling it pretty well on stage, but there's somebody in the audience 10 feet away, and they're cringing, and they're about ready, they'll faint. Mm-hmm. And they're not being touched with anything. All they have is visual stimulation, and that's so extreme for them that they'll pass out. And that just shows you these reactions are very much internal.
And how, now you've been doing this a long time, has it flowed through even the sort of unexpected pains of stubbing your toe and stuff like that, or is that a whole different?
There's kind of a whole different, if I'm prepared for something, it'll change how I'm going to react to it. If something takes me by surprise, and I'm going to react pretty much like anybody else. And there are different types of pain, There's a difference between a puncture with a pin and getting your, you're hitting your thumb with a hammer and a burn. And but once you become aware of that you have some control over it, you can deal with it. It's like a new type of pain. It's like, okay, there it is, and then how can I change the reaction to it and the perception of it?
Mm-hmm. And there must be days though where you're touring and you're tired, you've been driving a long time, and you maybe lose a little bit of the ability to control it and have to face it.
I will have bad days. There are some times it's actually kind of strange. Sometimes when it's like nothing at all, like it's completely, it seems like you're invincible or something like that. And there are some times where I'll feel it more, and I may not necessarily know why.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I might be, and this can be happening, where I'm really exhausted, traveling a lot, and all of a sudden it's just, when I'm on stage, it's a completely different thing. I will have it when I'm like completely exhausted before a show and I'm falling asleep, but as soon as I step out on stage, it's an entirely different zone. It's something else. And I'll be animated and awake and reacting fine. And that's a lot of it is because of it's a routine that I'm in. It's something my mind and body expect because I've done it so many times. I mean, I'll be touring, I'll be doing it at least 5 days a week. So it knows what's going to happen, and it will change for that. And you might have experienced that in other aspects of your life. As soon as you start doing something, even no matter what you feel like beforehand, it'll just change completely.
Mm-hmm. You said, I remember the previous time we talked, you just said the feeling of invincibility, and I think that say in the Middle East, people who are doing these acts, there's almost a religious invincibility, and that's a testament to their faith.
You could say that. There's different people who do similar things or things that look similar for different reasons with some similar results. There are some people you're probably most familiar with are the Hindus on the bed of nails or having their hand raised above the head. And that's like the putting yourself in a state of discomfort on purpose. Just kind of giving up the material world and taking it one step further. Not only have I given up all my material possessions, but now I'm kind of uncomfortable. So you've taken it a little step further, showing you you're even beyond that. The Sufis who do this, actually the word fakir, which is thrown around, is actually an Arabic word.
Well, that's why I was sort of, I don't know if these are Sufis, but I was thinking of the images that were played on CNN a few years back in Saddam Hussein's...
Actually, I've heard of those and have not seen them, but that's probably Arabic use of fakir. But with that, it's more of the state, when you do that, it's part of a bigger thing, and people get obsessed with it. There are people who are part of the orders that do this, but they don't do it in the United States or the Western world, simply because people either get obsessed with the whole piercing part of it or get shocked by it and turn away from the entire the entire thing. So, but it's more, it's showing you that when your mind's in a certain focused on God, that you're in this state where you're protected from all the pain and injury. And if you've seen, there are some videotapes and photographs from a group from Jordan where that I've looked at, and probably you've seen too, where there's some incredibly extreme penetrations happening. Some injuries that would appear they should be fatal with very little
front to back swords
and sideways and going through. I know there's some going through the side of the neck behind the throat. I've heard tales of very extreme things, which I cannot verify. But
does seeing these things make you, and then sort of knowing at least with some level of certainty that it can be done, make you want to move into that?
Yes, that's kind of heightened my curiosity. I have been studying Sufism. In fact, the very kind which the people who skewer themselves in the Middle East do. One thing, a Sufi is a word. There's the word Sufi, dervish, and fakir. Basically, all mean the same thing. But there are different aspects of it, different expressions of it. And the group you're mostly familiar with, I'm sure, is the whirling dervishes. You see those images of people spinning around. And that's one particular sect. But there's a couple of different sects that do the skewers through the body. And they're called the Rafi, is the one most known. And they would be known as howling dervishes. If you go look in old books, like old travel documents, they're called howling dervishes. Because part of their religious ceremony, they're making this heavy, deep breathing, and it sounds to the Western ear, because if they're speaking Arabic, it just sounds like they're doing these strange howling motions and noises. But there's a group in Northern California I've been studying with, which is the same, I guess, from the Rafi dervishes. And they don't do the skewering, as I said, for the reasons said. The Western world doesn't really know how to understand that. But it's the same philosophy behind it. But it is the changing of the focus of the mind, the taking yourself away from the ego. Because when you're in pain, part of it is, if you're in pain, you're thinking, oh me, I'm in pain, ooh, I'm in pain. But they see themselves as more of a, you know, an extension of something much bigger. And when you take yourself away from focusing on your internal, you know, your needs and your desires, then it's not such an extreme thing.
Mm-hmm. I want to jump back, and so and sort of get our history back completed. So you're in high school. You're starting to, I guess, amuse yourself and your classmates to some extent.
Yeah, in junior high school, and then I'd read about, you know, fire eaters. I'd seen fire eaters. I found that very fascinating and wanted to do that. But everything I knew was very dangerous. And people would actually, I'd try to get people to help me. And it's like, no way, man, because I'm like some junior high school kid saying, I want to play with fire, you know. I want to stick pins in my body. And people are saying, oh, you know, don't even think about that. You don't want to do that, man. But I'd gotten some books on fire eating, a very good one, but I didn't want to do it unless I had some personal instruction. And I met this circus that was traveling through town. It was actually called the Wenatchee Youth Circus, and I think they still travel in that area in the Northwest. And they had some people there who taught me a little bit. So fire eating was something I've been doing since I've been about 15 or so.
And your fire eating has evolved a great deal over time.
Yes.
I don't know, because I think that maybe there's an aspect of illusion as well, but there's a I think I remember reading on your website that you do a fire act where you inhale the fire and then bring it back out again.
Well, I'm doing techniques which are kind of advanced. They're, it could be called fire breathing, but basically I'm treating the flame so it were smoke or smoke rings, so I can blow a little balls of flame out and then jump from one torch to the other and hold the flame burning in my mouth, and it'll jump out like 2 or 3 feet. And not like when people think fire eater, spitter, or breather, they think about somebody taking a big swig of some flammable liquid and spitting it out, making this huge flame. It's much different. If you've seen that, it's different than that. It's like little
little even smoke rings of flame just dancing out. And I don't even do the spitting the big flame, because I think a lot of people do that. In fact, it's the first thing I think a lot of people do.
Well, I was going to say, fire breathing is the thing that everyone seems to try.
Yeah, yeah.
Just so that we don't get ourselves in trouble, what sort of risks is a person facing trying this without any real guidance?
Well, trying it with guidance is pretty risky.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to stress, everything that I do in the show is dangerous, and I know techniques that'll protect me, but it's one of these type of things where if I make a mistake, the consequences can be quite severe. And something like fire, especially, you've got to be very respectful of it. It's very dangerous. You know, there are reasons there are all these fire codes everywhere. There's been a lot of disasters as people have been careless with fire, and it will really, really mess you up. You may think, oh, I know what I'm doing, but the minute you turn your back, it can jump on you. So even something like fire eating and the skewers in the body, you know, blood poisoning is a possibility if you're doing that wrong, aside from injuring some vital part of the body. Almost everything I do does have a potential for injury, no matter how slight. Sword swallowing, for instance, there's been a rash, or like last year, there was a whole bunch of injuries, people swallowing swords, both, you know, people just doing it as a bar bet. There's actually a Canadian guy, I think in Hamilton, Ontario, who swallowed a sword, but he swallowed somebody's sharp sword and punctured his lung. But even professional sword swallowers had recently ripped the esophagus, which is the most common injury I've heard about. You get a tear in the esophagus, it just gets infected like that, and that'll put you in the hospital. If you puncture the stomach, even worse, can lead to peritonitis, can lead to death very quickly if not taken care of. So everything does have this great degree of risk.
And also, you're not just doing I think that probably the play perishing that's just going through the surface skin on the scale of things is fairly safe, but you're going very, very deep with your piercings.
Yes, I'm doing some deep piercings in the show. And, yeah, the risk is great. I mean, this is where I have a chance of running into arteries, into nerve bundles. And if you've got a nerve...
Well, I was thinking that. You're going through the bicep, for example, right?
Yes.
And there are big nerve bundles that run through there. Do you worry that one day you're just going to clip that and that'll be the end of that arm?
Well, I have an awareness of what I'm doing. Came to do this, I've studied people, like photographs of people in other countries doing this, and then I get anatomy books and see exactly where I'm going, what I'm going to be hitting. There's like in the arm, hugging the bone, is this huge artery, and I know to stay away from that. So I'm going in areas which I know are pretty safe.
Pretty safe.
I mean, I know where my degree of danger is. You know, I'm not going in there blind. I'm not just jumping in there saying, let's see what happens if.
The first time you, let's say the first time you ran a skewer through deep muscle tissue, what was going through your head? What sort of state were you in?
I was kind of... Of course, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but there's an apprehensiveness to it. Sometimes people ask me if I have stage fright, even when I'm on stage, but there's more of kind of a respect for what's happening. I know I have to have a clear head, and especially the first time I'm doing something is even more. I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen, so I'm ready for anything, really. But I have, you know, awareness and foreknowledge of the possibilities, and I'm willing to take the risks which are would occur if I were to make a mistake. I pretty much got a list in my head of what could go wrong and how to deal with that. So, you know, life, I think the things in life you do, you've got to be able to take a risk, but also know the consequences of failure and be willing to take them. So I am very aware of what could go wrong.
Have you ever had to face those consequences, or have you been fairly lucky and prepared?
I've had some accidents in the show where I've hit an artery a few times.
But that's just bleeding.
That's just bleeding, but hitting an artery is a big freak out for a lot of people.
Certainly a freak out for the audience, I'm sure.
Oh, well, some of the audiences I did this for, one in particular, just loved it. It was like their favorite part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what's going to happen, but I've had things right where I'm doing the broken glass. I do broken glass. It's the one thing about my show. I'm doing things much more extreme than some other people doing this type of show would. I'm trying to be as authentic as possible. And to show the audience that there's nothing prepared, I'll take all the bottles out and break them up right there in front of them, pour them on the ground, then jump up on top of the freshly broken glass with my bare feet. And that's I'm only able to do this because I've had such a long experience. But even then, you know, it's broken glass and I'm going to make a mistake. And I've cut my foot open pretty bad one time.
Well, I think you had at least small cuts when I saw
I've
the show
I've had small
last.
Cuts now and then, but I've had a time when I just like, wow, something's just stuck in my foot. I take my foot up and there's like this piece of glass just hanging out of it. And now my thing is, you see, part of the thing I'm doing is it's about entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing I think some people doing a kind of performance piercing or something like that miss is that first and foremost you've got to entertain, and you can do shocking things, but if you just have shock, once the shock's gone, you're just left there. You've got to entertain. So I'm doing a show, I get an injury, I've kind of, the show must go on.
Mm-hmm.
I got my foot kind of cut open and I've got to like go on with the show and try to pretend my foot's okay. So I'll have something like a towel on the ground with my foot pressed against it, and I'm kind of sliding along, sliding that foot along the ground until it's coagulated, and go on with the show. And then when the next act comes on, I'll try to bandage it up a little bit, but gotta keep going with the show.
All right, I think we have you at 15 now, breathing fire.
Okay.
And you're still in high school?
Yeah, well, I live in a small town in Washington State, and if you live in Washington State, you're going to end up, or even like areas surrounding that, you end up in Seattle if you're at all, you know, interested in something other than living in a small town. Yeah. So I was living in Seattle for a long time. You know, a local band was opening up, maybe between their set, and I would walk in broken glass or eat fire or something like this. One thing I did, I would eat fire for Henry Rollins' poetry reading when he was first doing his spoken word thing. Mm-hmm. You know, one of his first tour. I was the... And in fact, he did his poetry reading, then I ate the fire, so I could say...
He opened for you.
If I wanted to. But, sure. So I was just kind of doing stuff here and there in Seattle, but nothing really big.
And then I guess shortly afterwards you were involved in the startup of Jim's show?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing, you know, as I said, it was kind of a weird hobby of mine. I was just like some kind of punk rock guy, really, in Seattle. And I would do this now and then, but it was kind of my hobby, and I was building things up. I mean, I'd do a fire eating act, and it would be like, you know, 5 minutes or something like that. You had the broken glass, and it's another 5 minutes or so. So, yeah, the formation of the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow, Jim Rose was doing this ad for this show. This flyer showed up in town. He's going to be doing... I should back up a little bit. One guy in Eastern Washington who was kind of influential was this kind of hippie circus guy named Reverend Chumley, who actually has a website up now. He just put a new website up. But he was one of the guys I first saw walk in broken glass. He would perform at the university. They have these kind of entertainment things that'll come through the university, and because it's a small town, my dad was a university professor, I'd often go to the university and see what the students were seeing. But he was involved with the show where they had fire eaters, and he was walking in broken glass and a few other things, doing the bed of nails, and he was an influence to me. So anyway, I see these flyers of Jim Rose doing his show, and it lists all these things, and I didn't go to his first show. It's a strange thing. But I said, oh yeah, I've seen Reverend Shumley doing this. It's probably something like that. And he did another show, and actually this guy at the magic shop in Seattle called Pike Place Magic kind of forced me on the phone with Jim Rose. He said, you got to meet this guy. I know you guys like the same thing. He actually picked up the phone, dialed Jim Rose, and shoved the phone in my ear, and here I am kind of in this awkward conversation with Jim Rose. And that's the first time I met him. At that point, he was doing a solo show. And it was, as everybody's beginning shows are, pretty unrefined, kind of needed some work with the stage presence and things like that. But it was people were coming out to see it. They hadn't heard of anything like this in a while. Anyway, at that show, a few other people had met. Jim Rose was Joe Herman, who went on to be Mr. Lifto. And later on, he'd met Paul Lawrence, who we know as the Enigma these days. And Matt the Tube was a friend of mine. Well, actually, I had got him doing this. Matt Crowley was doing this. He just had a friend of his who was a doctor or nurse or something like that, gave him as a gag one of these nasal feeding tubes. And Matt, for his own amusement, because this is the type of guy he is, he thought, well, maybe I can do this and do it as a bar bet, and I can go to a bar and bet somebody I can drink a beer down my nose. And so he was working on that, and I actually had him do his first performance, which was before Jim Rose had come to town, in a show that I was a part of, which was kind of a subgenius, Church of the Subgenius revival show in town, and I was playing the part of the Mad Doctor, and I had him come on stage as the audience member, and during the course of the act, he did his tube act and drank this beer down his nose. So Rose met Matt the Tube through me, and we did the first show we all did together was in this little teeny thing, little teeny cafe downtown called Cafe Sophie, and then it kind of became a bi-weekly thing we were doing at a club called the Crocodile Cafe, and we're doing shows every two shows in the middle of the week, Wednesday and Thursday, every 2 weeks, and that went on for a long time.
Okay.
Do I go on? Every little detail.
No. I think the history of that show has been fairly well documented.
Yeah,
overall.
That's all fairly well documented. Of course, the big break was when Lollapalooza came around. They were actually looking specifically for a rock and roll side mm-hmm. sideshow, and there we were.
You guys, got huge.
Got
and let's. The only thing I wanted to ask about that is because I've heard a couple stories. Is it true that Enigma got tattooed on a dare?
No.
Okay,
I'll tell you the Enigma thing. He was actually pushing for this. He's like, I want to be blue. And I want to be blue. It'd be good if I were blue. Because, I don't know, that's just the way his head works. Really. I don't want to really try to get inside his head, because I've done that before, and it's confusing to me. But, and we were saying to him, it was like saying, well, you know, you could dye yourself blue, and then if you don't like, and it'll wear off and see what you like, and there are these things you can take that'll turn you different colors, and he's like, no, I gotta get tattooed blue. And actually, Jim Rose was against it at first, but he just started to do it. And at that point, he had just started to, as we know, to blossom. He did, he was first started out by, like Ashley Talbot started doing the first bits of his tattoos, which you can see on his legs. And but then he started having Katzen do it. Did most of the rest of them. But I think from the
Katzen was sort of a friend that tagged along with the show at that point.
Katzen, actually, I was there when they met. I was at attendance at the table. They met at a little Five Points in the Lollapalooza tour, a little Five Points in Atlanta.
and at outside this pizza restaurant there. And they became involved, and as you know, now completely intertwined. And yeah, she started doing the tattoos. I think she was learning specifically so she could tattoo him from head to foot.
Excellent. Anyway, let's jump right forward to where you you left the show. Do you want to talk about that?
I can talk about that. Yeah.
Okay. What initiated that?
Well, I was not getting I'm not happy with the direction the show was going, but basically the whole thing, just really sum it up. So the beginning of the show, it was all like it was some kind of big thing we were all going to be doing together. But as the show was going along, it just felt like I'm kind of an employee, and like it's not going to be something I'm going to be a part of, but something I'm just another, you know, employee at Burger King. I was hoping, you know, to be part of this big project, this big stage production, but I had very little to say, and I actually stopped saying stuff because it didn't seem to do me any good. I was somebody who was putting a lot into the show, but not getting that much out of it.
Well, you were probably doing the most physically demanding act.
But also a lot of the research, because I've been researching this type of act for a long time, and I was always being pushed with, well, we need something new for the show. What are you going to do next year? What are you going to do now? And I would come and do something, and it would be like, all I'm going to get out of it is he's going to, like, again say, well, I need something else. And while other people in the show weren't doing that much, and were getting, you know, the same amount of reward from it, whether it be, you know, basically my pay was going down because of that, because I'd have to pay for my own equipment, which I'm kind of fine in the end, because that means I get to keep it when I leave, of course.
That's true.
But as you know, I was getting, my pay was getting diminished with each thing, and the work I was doing was increasing with each thing I was putting into the show.
Your pay was diminishing?
Yeah, well, basically, because when I say that, because if I take out of my own paycheck to put,
right.
You know, so the more work I put into it, the less I was actually taking home. But as well as the show was not going in the direction I wanted, I was hoping it to be, and I found some of the things to be kind of crude, and I was interested in having a classic type of act. Everything I do in the show is something that would happen, you know, in another country, and in fact, it's very fascinated with the whole, you know, Middle Eastern type of act. And some things that happened in the show, you know, were fun, but something I would never do, you know, like the whole tube act was fun, and but it was nothing I would do myself. It was simply because it's not classic. I'm kind of reviving these things that are lost, going, you know, way back hundreds of thousands of years. Some of them, like the one thing I do with the walking on red hot metal, or the stepping on the red hot metal, is something I read about happening in medieval times. And as far as I know, I'm the only person on earth who's doing that. But it was almost completely lost.
Do you feel on a historical level that it's important that someone keeps doing these shows, and they stay alive and not just be, you know, recorded events?
To some degree, I agree with that. Not to the extent that I'm willing to sacrifice myself for that. You know, I'm not just going to throw the information around just to keep it alive, because that'll, I'll probably kill it, actually.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, eventually you'll be an old man and you'll want to retire.
Yes, and I'll be doing my infomercial, and I'll turn you into a Superman.
Well, seriously, will you do that? Will you eventually train people and pass on, you know, the research that you've done, or do you think that people should go through that process themselves?
Well, I think if you want something, it doesn't matter really what it is. If you really want something, you're going to achieve it. You're going to find a way to get the information. I mean, there was many times I was trying to find information. There was a guy who swallowed swords. I was just kind of begging him to teach me, and he's like, "No way, kid. You know. Now I'm swallowing swords. There's not just one option. You can always, you know." I had to look through all kinds of different ways, and in fact, that's made me the act a lot better, because one thing I think is that people in the sideshows that are kind of apprenticed by one person, And you'd learn, if you talk to the old old-time sideshow people, to go, oh, that's not the way you do it. Here's the way you do it. This is the way. This is how so-and-so taught me, and so-and-so taught him, and so-and-so taught him. So you've got this one thing being replicated. Because I've never had anybody show me the one correct way, I've been able to use my own experience and knowledge and come up with some kind of different techniques and do some things that aren't really supposed to be possible. Mm-hmm. Or were actually more surprising to people who think they know how it's done than maybe to the mainstream audience.
When you left Jim's show, he made, I guess, what at least to me seems like would probably be a fairly hurtful statement, and I think an inaccurate statement. I think it was something along the lines of, torture kings are dime a dozen, it'll be no big deal to replace them. But at the same time, I think your show, you know, is it's very unique, and there's a lot of acts that you do that really no one else is doing. I think the one you see popping up in the magazines all the time is where you swallow string and then cut it out of your stomach. Now that's an act you never did in Jim's show.
I'll tell you the first thing here before we go beyond it. Yes, Jim Rose. You see, before I was in the show, he called me the greatest, you know, sideshow performer in history, the most complete sideshow performer in history, known world, all over the world. And as soon as I leave a show, it's like, oh, he's nothing, you know? So you can pretty much tell what's going on there. That's kind of his...
Well, it's
his
marketing,
his
too.
...spin on things, you know, that's what he's going to say. It's like, oh, he was no good anyways. But, of course, I'm still here doing the act 5 years later, so...
I don't think anyone has ever, at least not in modern history, maintained an act like this successfully, other than yourself.
And the string thing is a weird thing. There were some things, this was really, I was doing research and development while I was in the Jim Rose Circus sideshow, but in my head, I was like, why should I give it to him? It's like, he's going to like, there's a lot of stuff he does in the act still, that basically I showed him how to do. And I showed people in the show how to do, and he's doing it in his show, even like some kind of toned down versions of it. And then he has the book he wrote, and he says, like, I'm the guy, you know, who taught the torture king how to do this, basically. So I had a lot of things I had researched and just put that in the back drawer of my mind in case they were going to leave the show. Seeing a lot of it, there was a point where I was very indecisive. We made this videotape. And I said, well, I'm just going to stay with the show and see what happens with the videotape, and that's going to make my mind up. If the videotape takes off, if there's a lot of success from that, if that's very beneficial for me, I'll stay. If not, maybe I'll leave. And what happened with the videotape is I received like less than $100 for it, even now to this day, from a videotape that...
I've seen it in a zillion stores.
Out of print.
Yeah.
It went through its complete running, so... That tells you something there. The string thing is a feat that you read about in certain books. It's a genuine feat from India. I've researched it enough. It's not exactly what you think it is. But the method I'm doing is nothing that you've ever read anywhere. People think they know how it's done, but they don't know how I'm doing it.
I'm not going to say how it's done, and I'm not going to say I know exactly how it's done, but I have a vague idea, and even that is, it doesn't take any of the magic away from it, you know?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's not what it says it is, but it's certainly not, it's nothing you buy.
It's not an illusion, certainly.
It's not an illusion, it's nothing you buy at a magician store. If a magician found out how it was done, he'd be shocked, they'd turn pale.
Yeah.
But, it's something I've been doing and my own unique method and getting a lot of attention with it. So it shows you, and before I had been doing it, it was just some weird story in books. A lot of things I've been doing are like that. You'd read about them in these old books. Oh, so-and-so supposedly did this, and here's... And a lot of these books that are like how to do sideshow stunts are like, you can tell the person who wrote them has never done them at all in their life. They're just kind of hearing tales from other people of how it's done, and then they kind of paste them up. I can even trace some of them word for word from old pamphlets, and some of the things are just like, will literally kill you if you do what they say. There's like all these formulas to how to make your mouth fireproof. There's one of them that has a mercury. You put mercury in your mouth, it'll make your mouth fireproof.
Well, I think that, like Scott from Carnival Diablo was telling me the reason that he can do the electrocution act is because he eats a special diet to change the electrolytes in his blood so he can accept massive amounts of shock. You know, I think if someone were to replicate that, it would be the end of some kid, certainly.
Yes, it would. So there's a lot of misinformation floating around about how to do these things, and a lot of dangerous information as well.
Now, but I think that at the same time, the misinformation is part of the act, and it's part of the entertainment aspect of the act, because it builds up even though, you know, there is a, you know, an intensely demanding physical aspect to it, there is still a certain amount of, you know, illusion and traditional magic.
Well, it is
magic.
A performance. People have to remember this. The main part of the show is performance. It's entertainment. It's not like a seminar. It's not like a doctor's dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
People have got to be entertained, and that's the main thing.
Now, recently, mainstream magic has started sort of moving into the same thing with, you know, guys like David Blaine doing what amounts, I think, to sideshow, and referring a great deal to, doing replicating older acts. Do you think that? Do you think you'll ever be in Times Square doing a massive, massive show?
Will I be in Times Square? Well, if I'm frozen in Times Square doing a massive show, I hope I won't have a catheter tube and a feeding tube.
And a sweater.
That's cheating. Really, some of us, I didn't see that last thing, but...
Well, yeah, I think he got to put a sweater on partway through.
Well, yeah, he's, David Blaine's, I think he's drawing a lot of things from some obscure sources, but doesn't really have a complete...
Well, I don't
not
think
willing to take
certainly
the
certainly the traditional magic community
but
doesn't have a great deal of respect for him.
I appreciate a lot of what he's doing because, I mean, he's out there getting a lot of attention. It's working, whatever he's doing. But it's the whole point about anything you're doing is it's not really the respect of your peers you're looking for here. You're looking for how the public's reacting, how the audience is reacting. So, from talking to the common people, they're entertained. They like what he's doing.
Yeah. Now, when you left Jim's show as well, you were doing a one-man show for quite a
Pretty
while.
Pretty much. I'm basically, you know, whatever's going to happen, I've basically figured out a way that I'm going to be the nucleus of the show. I'll be like, I'll always be there. I can do a show if it's just me, and I can do a show with a few other people. I've toured with just myself. I've toured with myself and a helper. I've toured with a couple of other performers as well, and I've got to be versatile. One thing is, it's not the old days. There's no, very few people are like in show business all the time. I can't really provide to some. If I'm going to have somebody else in the show, I can't really come to them and say, "Look, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be supported by me for the next, you know, year or two." I can't give them that guarantee. Simply because there's no vaudeville circuit anymore. I can't, you know, when I'm doing a tour, I'll set a tour up here and there. I'll be working for a couple of months. I might have a month off. I'll do a show here or there. I can't, like I did like a month-long tour. I had like a couple of weeks off, a New Year's show last week. I just did a show here, you know, yesterday, and I'm doing a show next week in Los Angeles for, I think it's the Survivor Party.
Survivor, like...
The TV series.
Oh, they're using you to kick it off?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. For some reason, I'm going to be in a desolate situation and somehow use my Torture King skills to survive. I'm not really sure how.
Will we get to see this on the opening? Or
it's just one of those Hollywood parties that you have. They usually have for these movies, they have a rap party.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those types of things. The Survivor party to kick it off. I once actually did a weird party for Maxim magazine. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
They had a big party in Los Angeles and had myself and a few other weird acts performing there. I've been making a lot more of my income from doing kind of small, you know, private shows.
You were
private
saying
events.
You just did a video release party? And
yeah.
You know?
When I'm on tour, I'm actually taking a really big risk. It's really expensive touring, and especially if I'm touring with other people and coordinating all that. It's really a lot of hassle compared to the money I get from that. But I love to do it. It's just that type of show that has to tour. It's really best seen live, and I like doing it in that type of environment. But I've had to do it in every type of different environment. From I'll work literally in an amusement park, a Renaissance fair, just a regular, you know, bar crowd, and then like some fetish event.
Mm-hmm.
So it can appeal to like all the way, yeah, all these different types of crowds of people.
When's the last time you worked like a regular job?
I haven't done anything regular in probably 5 years, you know, even that, 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
10 years now. I mean, I've done a few times. My most infamous job is I was a projectionist at a porno movie theater. And I would even do that when I was with the Jim Rowe Circus Sideshow. If I was in Seattle and had like some time off, I'd go and fill in dates for that.
Well, it beats paying, I guess.
It's just, you know, some skill. I could run a projector, and mm-hmm. there it was available. I get bored sitting around. Actually, I one of the reasons I like to tour is I just keep active, keep new situations occurring, too. So I haven't really lived in one place for many, many years. And because of that, it's really impossible to keep down a, you know, so-called regular job.
Yeah.
So it's kind of forced me to pursue this. That's part of my plan for success. When I left the Jim Rowe Circus Sideshow, I said, well, I've got to make sure I succeed with this. And one of my plans was to make make it physically impossible for me to do anything else. Otherwise, I'd fall into some other slump and fall away from it. To the extent that I had some tour that I was trying to get booked, there was a point where Lollapalooza was going to have the show again, maybe, you know, have me on, but it was all a bunch of talk, really. They mm-hmm. didn't have any money to offer, and it all fell through, and now I've got like 2 months where I don't have anything booked, so I'll go out and street perform. I head down to Key West and do sword swallowing on the street, and because I keep doing the act, it gets better, the whole performance. If you keep doing it no matter what, it's kind of like anything else. That's why if you're just doing it like that's a problem with people trying to do this type of show in a city. No matter, maybe something like New York or LA, you can get away better than other places. But after a while, people are going to see you and they're going to stop. Oh, we've already seen his show, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they'll stop coming, and then you'll be like, okay, what now? So touring and keeping performing has been important to the extent that if I'm not, when I'm touring, I'm living in like hotel rooms with a rental car. But I'm not touring, I'm living in a motorhome. So,
we're almost out of time, so let's let people know.
Yeah.
If you're touring, is there anywhere that people can go to find out? Do you have a web page?
Well, I had
but
one.
But is it? It's not really maintained right now.
No, it's died. The person who was running it was it doesn't run it anymore. It's actually might have had too many hits on it. It's tore up his whole website business.
Well, that's at least a little bit
so
good, I guess.
I am trying to get another web page up, but you can email me at Zamora King, ZAMORAKING, at AOL.com. So you want to get on my emailing list, and whenever I'm touring, whenever I'm performing, I send it out.
Excellent. I'll list that with the interview as well. Let's see. There's probably 1,000 people listening to this that, you know, have been wanting to try similar things. What advice would you have to sort of the young wannabe sideshow performer?
It depends what you want, why you want to do it, which is one reason. You should know why you want to be doing this. If you're for physically doing the acts, make sure you know what you're doing. Get as much information as you can through whatever.
I was going to say, where do you even get that information?
Where can you get it? You see, if you really want it, that's what I say.
Yeah.
If you really want it, you're going to find it. But I warn you, there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially now.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now. There's kind of been kind of a some people have muddied the waters with misinformation.
Some people. All right. Excellent. Tim, thanks a lot for talking to us today, and hopefully we'll see you next time you're in town.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. She has eyes that folks adore, so, and a torso even more. So Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia, oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo, beside it the wreck of the Hesperus too, and proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia, la-da-da. La da da, da da da. She can give you a view of the world in tattoo if you step up and tell her where. For a dime, you can see Kankakee or Parry or Washington crossing the Delaware. La da da, da da da, doo doo doo, doo doo. Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Oh Lydia, the tattooed lady. When her muscles start relaxing, up the hill comes Andrew Jackson. Lydia, oh Lydia, oh have you met Lydia? Oh Lydia, the champ of them all. She once swept an admiral clear off his feet. The ships on her hips made his heart skip a beat. And now the old boy's in command of the fleet. For he went and married Lydia.
I'm going to tell you guys one of my stories.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the patients who came to see me was a female-to-male transsexual. An individual born with male anatomy. With female anatomy, but psychologically male. This particular patient had gone to Dr. Laub at Stanford University for his surgery, and the first thing he wanted was testicles. Before any other operation, I later did a sex change type operation on him, but he first had gone to Stanford for the testicles. At that time, Dr. Laub was experimenting with an idea. He felt that for these female-to-male transsexuals, he could create a scrotum by putting something heavy enough in the labia, the female labia. The idea that gravity would drag them down and turn it into a scrotum. And so he had had his prosthesis experts at Stanford University make testicles, well, a mold the same size and shape as a testicle, out of lead, because it's so heavy, and coated it with silicone so there'd be no chemical reaction with lead. And this was what he was putting into people. And that request. And scheduled this patient for insertion of this into the labia, and the patient was in the hospital, had an IV running in his arm, had had pre-medication, so he was dopey, when in walked a guy who I'm sure was a resident, but I don't know whether you've been in the hospitals and seen how the interns and residents dress now. He said this guy looked like an orderly with long hair and the like, and came in and started telling him, I'm going to do your operation, and you need to go over the risks and so forth, and you know you might have this problem, that problem, and you might hemorrhage. And I said, hemorrhage? He said, yes, you might hemorrhage. And so as soon as the guy had walked out of the room, this guy pulled the IV out of his arm, and he got his clothes on, and he left the hospital. And so he wasn't about to go back to Dr. Laub. However, Dr. Laub had insisted they pay for these specially made testicles before the surgery, and so wife remembered, this person's wife remembered, and went back and claimed those lead testicles lined with silicone,
and
carries them to one of these pseudoplastic surgeons in Hollywood area, whose name I don't remember now, but I knew him quite well. And he put them, both of them in, and one of them rejected. And he put it back a second time, and it rejected a second time, as I could have predicted. My own experience, I learned not to ever put an implant back right after it rejects. You gotta wait for the tissues to recuperate. So far, when she'd heard about me and she came bringing this second testicle to me to put in, and I insisted they wait 3 months, and then I put it in and it stayed in, and then she had her create a small penis by the University of Oregon technique, and she was satisfied with the results, except about 3 years later she came to me and asked me to take out these lead testicles, which had not dragged down the scrotum.
Stayed up inside?
Yeah, they were, well, right at the labia. They weren't down like a true
set of balls.
True scrotum, it either got the same result by putting the lighter silicone implants in the first place. It was fine. I don't disapprove of experiments like that to try to do something, but what I'm saying is that she came to me to have those replaced with ordinary silicone testicular implants, and I asked her why. She said, because I'd like to fly on an airplane. No way was that individual going to go try to explain to those girls.
She still had balls.
I'm not going to do it. No way. She wanted to fly on an airplane. Not have to drive everywhere.
You have to have a letter from the Surgeon General.
Ooh.